males, and why is it that sons are more attached to their mothers? Now, we mentioned some things about personalities, how the personalities opposites attract to a certain extent. But I feel that there might be more to this subject. So, dear Sheikh, please.
Let me start from the other side first, because it gives a good clarity here. And then we will come to the children's side. If you look at the parents' side, that why is father more attached towards the daughter, is that the father knows that my son can protect himself, defend himself, take care of himself. However, somewhere deep down inside, the man does not have that confidence that my daughter can protect herself, take care of herself. Why? Because, again, a lot of daughters are sanguines, popular sanguines. So he notices their behavior in the house. He sees that, okay, she doesn't keep track of her books, she doesn't keep track of her shoes, she doesn't keep track of her clothes. So she needs a protective figure.
He sees them as fragile.
Exactly. So I have to be there to protect her. I have to be there to take care of her. Now, being a father, being that macho and that aggressive and that, you know, strong personality, he can't express himself with that kind of authority in front of daughter. So with the daughter, being that strong personality, he acts, you know, nicely and fragile and, you know, patiently and caringly. And the daughter also likes that, because at one end, she's getting all that care. On the other hand, she's feeling very secured and protected in the presence of the father. While she also notices that my mother, even my mother, when she wants protection, she goes to the father. When she wants that support
and
that
comfort,
and that shoulder and that courage, she goes to the father. So she learns from the mother that I need to get to the father for that protection, for that security.
Makes sense.
So this is how it works. The father has that sense of responsibility to protect the daughter, and the daughter, automatically looking at the mother, feels that need that if I want to feel protected and safe, I need to get to my father, and he's the person who's going to protect me.
What about the mother's attachment to her sons then?
Sons. Now, keeping in mind that father is not at home all the time. And this is where the mother looks at the son as the next best option to be that protector of the house. And then the son also finds that joy and finds that satisfaction of being the protector of the family at home. So a boy who reaches teenage, I don't know, if you look at some of the earlier movies, you know, like there was a movie, if I am not wrong, it was Mel Gibson. The name of the movie was Patriot. He had a son about 10 years old, and it was a war between the Redcoats and Whitecoats in America.
Civil War.
The Civil War. So he heads out in the war, and he appoints his 10-year-old son.
You're the man of the house. Yes, we still have this in our culture.
Exactly.
You're the man of the house when I'm not present.
Exactly. And what does this mean? You're the man of the house. Means that you are going to be the protector of the house. And mother looks at the son as the protector. And this is where the son feels that courage.
But even a small child who's only like 1 year old, even at that age, the mother's like, he's my protector.
Yes, to some extent, yes. The mothers always look at their sons as those who are going to be the protectors of the family.
At least going to be in the future.
So right from that time, the mothers have a special attachment towards the son. And the son also gets all that love from the mother, which he doesn't get from the father. And that's why there's a special bond between the mother and the son here.
Let's continue this very intriguing conversation after a quick break.
Inshallah.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Sheikh, just before we went on a quick break, you mentioned the reason that a mother's more attached to her son is because she sees him as the protector of the family, or at least the future protector of the family.
Correct.
Now, Sheikh, is that always the case? Is that the sole reason why the mother is more attached to her son and why the father is more attached to his daughters?
Not necessarily, but rather I would say the mother is more attached to all the children, in a way, right, to a certain extent, equally, I would say. But somewhere, the son, being the son, has an upper hand compared to the girls in the house and can take care of a lot of chores, which are outdoor chores.
Right.
And that's where the mother, in a way, shows certain amount of dependency on the son.
She depends on the sons.
The
right.
son, and yes. the son likes the fact that I have someone who trusts me, who depends on me.
I have responsibility.
Right. She's treating me like a grown-up person, and he appreciates that, and he likes that environment, that I'm being treated like a man in, of the house every time my dad's
right.
not around.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and that gives that confidence to the son. And therefore, these are some of the various reasons why there's the special bond and attachment between the son and the mother and the father and the daughter.
Right. Sheikh, let's circle back to our original topic, which was, now that we've spoken about this phase, about all of these attractions, naturally when a child, he enters this teenage phase with all of the hormones and all of that stuff, which is natural, they start to view the opposite gender in a different light, in a different
Correct.
Way. They start to develop attractions.
Correct.
Which we've mentioned before, it can lead to a disastrous and catastrophic result.
Correct.
As parents, and especially for parents who live in Western countries where it is much harder to manage their children and an Islamic lifestyle, what can they do to protect their children so that they may grow up and handle this phase, navigate this phase in an Islamic way which pleases Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
Correct. Like you pointed out, when the son reaches, or even the daughter, whenever the child reaches that puberty and that teenage, because of the hormonal changes, there's certain behavioral changes in them. A lot of people frown upon these behaviors. So when they notice their son looking at the opposite sex and, you know, probably staring, they get upset that, oh my God, my son, you know, he's getting carried away. Or if a girl is getting attracted towards a good looking boy. But this is natural. This is a natural process. Now, there are ways to manage this scenario.
Let's scrap these scenarios after a quick break.
All right, great. Let's come back and discuss them.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are now listening into the program Islamic Upbringing. Sheikh, we were talking about how parents, they should manage this life phase of the teenagers when they start to develop feelings and are attracted just generally to the opposite gender.
Correct. We were mentioning about different scenarios or different possible methodologies that can be used to manage this kind of a situation.
Right.
First and foremost, I would like to point this out, that when a person is idle and he doesn't have enough work or task at his hand, this is when he gets this extra spare time to sit and think,
which right? is very dangerous,
which is superbly dangerous, and we have riwayats,
many narrations that are prohibiting, I would say, do not be idle, especially
exactly.
for youngers,
especially yeah. when you're in that stage
yes.
or teenage where all your hormones are on you know, steroids and
overdrive,
going crazy
yeah. completely yeah
yeah they're working hard, they're doing overtime, all your
yeah.
hormones
right.
and at this time, if your child is sitting idle and does not have tasks at hand
and alone,
and
especially
alone,
if they have their own bedrooms, their own telephone device, their own
exactly.
laptop.
This is another point that we're going to discuss in our subsequent episodes about having their own personal rooms and having
yes.
their own personal devices. Inshallah, we'll talk about that.
Inshallah.
But here, sitting idle is going to leave their mind empty. And this is where they start thinking. And when they start thinking, it leads them towards those thoughts
leads
about the opposite
thoughts,
sex.
And then actions. And
exactly. So what do we do? One of the methods is not to let them be idle. Give them a task, assign them tasks. Remember the age groups that we mentioned about the first 7 years is the Sayyid, the
right.
kind of a...
Kind of the master.
The master of the yeah. house or, you know, the explorer.
Yeah.
And then the second one was Abd, meaning
the servant.
Slave, the servant. And the
yes.
third one was Wazir.
The now, minister or
exactly.
the
so
confidant.
Now when this teenage starts off and the child is at 14 years old, he's, according to the traditions, he's at that age of Wazir, meaning that he is now ready to accept tasks from you. Delegate
right.
tasks to him.
Responsibilities.
Give him responsibilities. Tell him shopping in your hand, lawn mowing in your hand,
right.
Probably dishwashing in your hand. I don't know. Based on the gender that you have. You have
right.
a daughter, assign her the kind of right. things that she can take care of.
Outdoor work is generally for the
for
men, the
boys,
for the boys.
And
yeah.
the indoor work for the girls, you know,
right.
Washing clothes or whatever. But assign them. Don't think that, oh, she's just 14, you know. Why should I?
She's
you know,
too young to learn to cook.
Exactly. And overburden her with tasks
right.
and all that. But if you're not doing that, then you're giving her a lot of extra free time
right.
to sit and ponder and think. And based on all the inputs that they're getting from the TV and from internet,
right.
from all the messages and the Instagram
even the foods
posts.
That we eat.
Everything. Even on your packagings.
Right.
Different food
yeah.
that you... And all those go into your brain as, you know, subliminal messages to your subconscious mind.
Right.
And they contribute to what you think.
Of course, we should also mention that people who criticize some of these traditional ways of raising children, like teaching the daughters how to cook and the boys how to do outside work, how to go shop and buy stuff and do things, is a bad thing. But in reality, we are teaching them necessary life skills. We are investments.
We're teaching them how to be self-sustaining, how to be self-sufficient, how to be confident
right.
and, you know, be independent in the future life.
In essence, yes. Sheikh, I would love to continue this discussion, but we are unfortunately out of time. I thank you for contributing to this discussion and also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any suggestions, feedback or some comments, please contact us at our email englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website parstoday.com. You can also find us on various social media websites such as on Twitter and Instagram under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
In the limelight.
Pentagon prosecutors have struggled for more than a decade to hold the trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his accused accomplices in the 9/11 attacks. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Carol Rosenberg and Charlie Savage. The piece is titled September 11 Prosecutors Are in Plea Talks That Could Avert a Death Penalty Trial. Stay with us. For more. Prosecutors have opened talks with lawyers for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the accused mastermind of the September 11, 2001 attacks. And his four co-defendants to negotiate a potential plea agreement that would drop the possibility of execution, according to people with knowledge of the discussions. Guilty pleas in exchange for life sentences could bring to an end the long-running case at the War Court, which was set up by the George W. Bush administration and has been mired in pre-trial proceedings focusing on the CIA torture of the defendants. Nearly a decade after the men were arraigned, the military judge has set no trial start date. No deal is expected soon, but guilty pleas resulting in life sentences could force the Biden administration to modify its ambition of ending detention operations at Guantanamo Bay and instead rebrand it as a military prison for a few men. In an earlier failed attempt at such talks during the Trump administration, the accused plotters demanded that they serve their sentences at Guantanamo Bay, where they are able to pray and eat in groups. They specifically did not want to be sent to the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado, where federal inmates are held in solitary confinement up to 23 hours a day. The five men are accused of directing and training or providing travel arrangements and money to the 19 hijackers who crashed four commercial planes into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and a field in Pennsylvania, killing nearly 3,000 people. A plea deal would undoubtedly disappoint, if not enrage, death penalty advocates among the victims' family members. But other 9/11 family members, including those troubled by the role of U.S. torture in the case and the delays, might see it as a fitting conclusion. The path to a trial for the accused September 11, 2001 plotters has been impeded by legal and logistic challenges, as well as a nearly two-year closure of the court during the coronavirus pandemic. The discussions began last week amid the latest setback. The judge, defense, and prosecution teams have traveled to Guantanamo Bay for 3 weeks of hearings meant to address disputes over evidence, particularly showing the role of the FBI in the CIA prison network, where Mr. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his co-defendants were tortured after they were captured in Pakistan in 2002 and 2003. But before they could start, Cherub Borman, the lead lawyer for one of the defendants, Waleed bin Attash, asked to step down from the case. She cited an unspecified in-house investigation of her performance and conduct by the Chief Defense Counsel, Brigadier General Jackie L. Thompson Jr. of the U.S. Army. No details were given, but the issue forced a delay in hearings that could stretch for months and provided an opening, according to a participant in the talks, between the prosecution and the defense. A lead case prosecutor, Clayton G. Trivett Jr., wrote on Wednesday to the defense teams proposing that they discuss whether pretrial agreements are possible for all five cases. "While I cannot guarantee that we will come to terms over these next 2 weeks," Mr. Trivett said in an email, "putting a concerted effort focused solely on possible agreements where we are all on board Guantanamo, where your clients and teams are present, may be our best chance of at least determining if deals can be reached." Within days, the five defendants and their lawyers met in the courtroom to compile an initial list of requirements for the guilty plea, starting with removing the death penalty from the case. Lawyers for the five men submitted a joint list on Monday, participants said. Although the prosecutors have begun the negotiations, a senior Pentagon official, known as the convening authority, must approve any deal. The role is currently held by Colonel Jeffrey Wood of the Arkansas National Guard, who is also a lawyer in Little Rock, Arkansas, and was appointed to the civilian job by the Trump administration. Participants said the talks were expected to continue through the month to try to reach some understandings to present to Colonel Wood. The interim chief prosecutor, Colonel George Kraher of the U.S. Army, declined to comment, as did the chief defense counsel, General Thompson. Both men are new to their jobs. Colonel Kreher was mobilized to the job from the Justice Department in October. General Thompson, who runs the defense office but represents no single defendant, took over on 1st of January. A month later, General Thompson wrote to President Biden to introduce himself, according to a person familiar with the matter. The general described the challenges that the military commission system had experienced in getting cases to trial and proposed a new effort to improve relations between prosecutors and the defense, which were strained and not conducive to plea negotiations. In early March, a lawyer at the National Security Council wrote back to General Thompson that the administration would not be taking a position on any of the cases, according to a senior administration official. The letter specifically did not take a position on plea deals, not endorsing the idea, but not discouraging it either. Instead, the official described the letter as saying that President Biden remained dedicated to responsibly reducing the detainee population at Guantanamo, which currently has 38 prisoners from the roughly 780 who were brought there from 2002 to 2008. 10 are charged but have yet to be tried. The White House's letter said reducing the population could include resolving the pending military commission's cases through pre-trial agreements, if appropriate, according to the official. But the letter also stressed that the White House would not prescribe what to do with any particular case or otherwise interfere with the process. Caroline Crass, the general counsel of the Defense Department, was copied on the reply, the National Security Council lawyer said. It is not clear what happened next, but on 4th of March, Colonel Kreher met by video conference with the lead lawyers in all current prosecutions and told them his case prosecutors had the authority to begin negotiations. Advocates for closure have suggested that some of the men who face charges could serve their sentences in the custody of another country. Convictions through plea deals might also persuade Congress, which forbids the transfer of detainees to the United States mainland, to lift the restriction for the purpose of incarcerating inmates who have been convicted in secure, more efficient settings. During the Trump administration, the convening authority, Harvey Ryshikov, was exploring the idea of plea agreements. Attorney General at the time, Jeff Sessions, found out about the talks, testimony in court showed, and called Defense Secretary James Mattis, demanding that there be no deals. Defense Secretary James Mattis then fired Mr. Ryshikov, citing unrelated reasons. A core issue is how many of the defendants beside Khaled Sheikh Mohammed would serve life sentences without possibility of parole, and whether some of the accused accomplices with lesser roles in the attacks would serve shorter sentences. Lawyers for two of the defendants, a Saudi prisoner, Mustafa Al-Housawi, and a Pakistani national, Amar Al-Baluchi, who is Mr. Mohammed's nephew, have described them as ignorant of the 11th of September 2001 plot, when they helped some of the hijackers with money transfers and travel arrangements from the United Arab Emirates. Psychologists conducting interrogations for the CIA waterboarded Khaled Sheikh Mohammed 183 times. Defense lawyers have pursued an overarching theory that because of its actions, the U.S. government lost the moral and legal authority to execute the defendants. Agents also kept the five defendants nude, beat them, strung them up by their arms in chains, and subjected them to steep deprivation during the 3 and 4 years they were held in the so-called CIA black sites before their transfer to Guantanamo Bay in 2006. As part of any plea agreement, the defendants would have to work with prosecutors through their lawyers on individual lengthy narratives known as a stipulation of fact, essentially a prosecution-approved admission of their crimes. Once signed, the men could be brought to court for questioning by the trial judge, Colonel Matthew McCall of the U.S. Air Force, on whether they cooperate willingly with the process. under war court law, military juries, not judges, sentence defendants who plead guilty generally from a range set in the plea agreement. The Pentagon would need to assemble a jury of U.S. officers to hear the statements and other presentations by both sides and then issue sentences, even if they're separately capped in secret pretrial agreements. That portion could last many months. People familiar with the talks said a military jury's recent reaction to descriptions of CIA torture of another prisoner in a lesser-known case might have contributed to the willingness of prosecutors to negotiate. In October, the jury condemned as a stain on the moral fiber of America the agency's cruel treatment of Majid Khan, a confessed courier for al-Qaeda, and urged the overseer of military commissions to grant clemency.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. You are listening to Viewpoints and analysis on different topics according to the Islamic calendar of the Muslim world. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Brother Sajjad Haider. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
And Brother Sajjad Haider, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for the invitation.
So before starting our main discussion, I would like to express my condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Ali alayhi salam in the holy month of Ramadan. That's why we dedicated today's session of the program Viewpoints to the universal character of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And the main question is this: how we can benefit from the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in today's world, in the contemporary world. Sayyid Mohsen, let's start with you. After Prophet Muhammad, the most comprehensive character in the Islam, it is believed by both Sunni and Shia believers, according to different documents, is Ali ibn Abi Talib, Imam Ali alayhi salam. But in today's world, in the 21st century, if we want to learn something from this character, what it would be?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, we can see that even in today's world, there are many writers who are quoting the, the sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, and he's been the role model for the mankind since he came to this world. Yes. And even the book Nahjul Balagha, obviously, the peak of eloquence, it's been translated as this. Yes. Name.
Sayyid al-Razi's book.
Sayyid al-Razi's collection. Yes. Of the sayings of Imam Ali or the speeches of Imam Ali. This book is a magnificent book, which is being said that it's a treasure, basically. And when we look at this book, even there are many things which can teach us a lot.
Yes.
A Christian writer, George Jardak, who was Lebanese, I think.
Yes, he was Lebanese.
He was a Lebanese writer.
Al-Imam Ali Sautul Adalat
al-Insaniya. Yes. So he talked about the justice of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Yes. And the rights. And we know that even in his life, the tenure that he had, the apparent. Yes. Tenure of rulership that he had or governorship, that was for 3.5 years or 4 years. It was basically full of justice.
Yes.
The things that we see, even the wars that he had, he was a role model for everyone, even at the time when he was, because he used to even fight with justice. This is what we lack in today's world. You know, people or the countries who have powers, they invade countries, they do not look at the justice or injustice. We recently have many, you know, wars, the war on Yemen, the war on Afghanistan, on Syria, war between Russia and Ukraine, and other wars as well. We see that generally the governments or the armies, they don't care about the people. There are many things that are mass destruction, like many weapons, and it's against justice. And that's why in the Shia Islam, they have forbidden the manufacturing of atomic bomb. Because it's a mass destruction weapon. Every faqih, all the maraji has given this this fatwa. So it shows us that in Islam, especially Imam Ali, who is the leader and the successor of the Prophet, according to the Shia Islam, and he's the first Imam. Therefore, we can see that the justice is the main thing.
Very good.
In this. And then in today's world, we lack justice.
That's all right. That's why it attracted so many people out of the scope of Islam, we can say, and the Shia Islam, to the justice of Imam Ali alayhi salam, not only during his caliphate, and I mean during these 4.5 years, but during all his life, you know, the justice of Amir al-Mu'mineen was really outstanding. Okay, Brother Sajjad Haydar, what about you? How we can benefit from this important character, Imam Ali alayhi salam, in today's lives, in today's world?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Regarding the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam, I think the first step, if you want to benefit from a life and personality of some person in history, the first step is to know the personality, who the person was. So when we come to Imam Ali alayhi salam, he was one of the great persons of the history. Now, the point here to be noted is this, that we are not talking about a person actually here now. We are talking about actually not only a person, but actually a method, actually, a system given by Holy Prophet to the humanity. There are two points which I want to focus here. The first point, that the prophets, there is a very good saying by one of the contemporary scholars. He said, the prophets do not write books. Their books are actually the souls and selves of people. There they mold them in their personalities to the higher merits of ethics and virtues.
That's right.
So that's what their action. So the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam is very much related to the personality of the Holy Prophet. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if you want to know what Islam is capable of, if you want to know what the Prophet has given to the humanity, look at Ali alayhi salam. He manifests the greatest standards of Islam.
Quran and Natiq, they say. Quran and Natiq. The practitioner of the Quran.
So even Quran is not a book of Holy Prophet. It's from Allah. So if the Holy Prophet brought that hidden, the gift of Quran from the hidden, from Al-Ghaib, Sama Al-Ghaib, but in another aspect, for the people, normal people of today's world, we tell them that in every condition you are living, how much the conditions are hard and difficult, it's possible to bring up it's possible to nurture people on highest merits of standard. An example is Ali alayhi salam. This is the one aspect. Okay. The other point which I want to talk about, in today's world we see that after the Renaissance and afterward the things in the materialistic system has developed into, that has taken all order and systems of the world, we see that in ethics, the ethics has been based upon the pleasure.
Yes.
And the economy has been founded upon the capital.
Yes.
And the politics and everything you see is based on materialism. So we very much need in this time to return to a personality like Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Right.
When we are too much indulged, there is too much indulgence to the materialistic life.
Yes.
So we need to return to Ali alayhi salam and his life, and to know the personality. So this emotional attachment even works.
Okay.
And to get out of this miserable, I will call it a miserable state, where the materiality and material aspects are taking over all and overcoming all our human aspects. So it's a good time to return to such a great personality.
Inshallah, mashallah, brother, it was really nice. His teachings, his sentences, his statements, his sermons, letters are really fresh. You know, it is like it was written yesterday. Yeah. When you look at it, just take a look at the letter of Imam Ali alayhi salam to Malik al-Ashtar, you know, when he was sent as a governor to Egypt. You know, nowadays all the leaders across the world can really benefit from the teachings and the content of that letter. Okay, Sayyid Mohsen, justice and social justice, this type of Hurriya, the freedom that Imam Ali alayhi salam had, you know, in his character, you know, we can say taking care of the orphans, taking care of the destitute. Most of the social movements nowadays, those who are seeking for freedom nowadays in the world, are looking for a paragon, for a role model, for, a charter of rights. Imam Ali alayhi salam, I think, can be a good example, isn't it?
Yes, definitely Imam Ali is a good example. Why? Because when we look at the history, we see even the sayings of Prophet about Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. The personality that he had, it was, we can say, like, it covered everyone, everything. It was a universal. He was a universal person.
Yes.
The Prophet said about him, like, Al-Aliyu ma'al haq wal-haqu ma'ali. Ali is with the truth and truth is with Ali. Now, someone can be with the truth, but if the truth is with him, it means he has a high rank. Whatever he does, it's according to the justice and the truth. On the other hand, we can see, like, for example, when Prophet says that I am the city of the knowledge,
yes.
Ali is the door of that knowledge,
the gate of knowledge.
Gate of that city.
Yes. Yes.
And whoever wants to enter the city, he must enter through the gate.
Yes, very good.
So from that aspect, even today, when we want to learn something, when we want to, gain a knowledge, we have to gain some help or take some help from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. On the other hand, in his personal life, as you said, all the movements that we see, it was done by him. For example, you know, today we have people who are living in the streets. Hunger is a lot. The people who are needy, the poor people, they don't have any food. He used to supply food in the mid of night without everyone knowing about it to those orphans, to those who were needy.
Okay.
And when he passed away, and those people couldn't have anything to eat or drink, then
the sustenance was cut.
And they understood that, okay, this was Ali ibn Abi Talib, who was the caliphate of the time. He was the ruler of the time.
Yes.
We don't have any ruler going into the streets and distributing things amongst the people. He was very much careful about the things. For example, you know, today we can see, like, for example, if I have something from my office, I do use it at home as well, for example.
Okay.
But when I'm at my work time, I'm doing my personal things as well. Whereas when Imam Ali alayhi salam, we have this in the history, that he had a candle and he was writing something on the papers of the government. He was basically calculating some of the money that has come to him.
Okay.
And at the same time, he had private guests. So he turned off the candle.
It was Talha and Zubair who came to him to visit him. And the candle
was a personal visit.
And the personal candle was on, yes.
So he turned off the government candle, like the candle which was bought from the government's money.
Yes.
And then he turned on the private candle which he bought by his own pocket. So this thing shows us that he was very specific and he was paying attention to many detailed things.
That's right.
Which has effect. Obviously, when we are living in this universe, in this world, we are affecting this world.
Yes.
This world is being affected by us in different means. Those who just believe in the material life, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam was even role model for him.
Mm-hmm.
That if you want to have justice according to this, the way we said, okay, you need to follow the footsteps of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Okay.
If you want justice, if you want to talk about helping people, it is Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. If you talk about the rights of the people, the best judge of the history, we can say, was Ali ibn Abi Talib.
There are so many documents that there has been disagreements between Khulafa al-Rashidin, a specific case when referring to them as a court, they could not answer that and they referred the case to Ali ibn Abi Talib, you know.
Even the right of Imam Ali was being the caliph, the first caliph after the Prophet, apparently.
Okay.
But even we see that when this right was taken from him, he is observed as an opposition. But at the meantime, whenever there was anything which was needed by them or
any help or any consultation,
he was the first person who used to give his consultation and his advices to the caliph of the time.
Okay.
So it shows us, and the unity that he had. You know, we do not see any dispute at that time of war the way we see in today's war.
No.
at this time that we have between the Sunni, Shia, that's and all right. those. So basically, this all shows us that we need to follow, and even if we want to have any kind of movement, we should follow him, basically.
Okay, that's right. Okay, Brother Sajjad Haider, your final remarks?
Yeah, I'll say that in a time when there, even in the political aspect, yes. you see the, powers in the world today, even starve the nations to death. We see this, they starve the nations to death just for a political gain. So for nations, it's a time that they, when they follow a person like Imam Ali alayhi salam, and they return even to their own legacy. Okay, philosophical right. legacy, or if they take a lessons from the life of a person like Imam Ali alayhi salam, maybe the things will change in future. And it's a, I think even in political aspect, it's a good opportunity for humanity to take benefit from the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
That's right. He was a man of action and not only words, you know, because there are so many documents written about the lifestyle of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Taking care of the family, you know, even the family aspect can be also a really good role model. Today in the world, you know, there are so many consultation centers, how to have a family, how to have good relation with your wife, with your children, you know, this and that. Imam Ali alayhi salam, personal life even was a role model and example for so many people. It still can benefit from them.
Yeah, it's the greatest thing. He is a multifaceted person.
Yes,
and also being a multifaceted person, he excels in every field. That's the point.
Yes, that's
he excels in spirituality. So even all the systems which we used to see today in philosophy or either Irfan or other all aspects, we see they look at Imam Ali as the role model, as the leader.
So even physical strength, you
strength,
know?
Yeah.
Okay. He was, I mean, physically strong too, you know. So many stories about his bravery during the battlefields, you know, defending the religion of Islam. I mean, you cannot find a person who has all these things, all these, you know, great talents in himself. A person who is believed to be the first man among the Muslims, a person who were the first one who believed in Prophet Muhammad's mission, the true successor of Prophet Muhammad, and then the personal life, the social life, his authority over the people in 4.5 years, you know, full of justice, really, really a comprehensive character still can be benefited from.
Okay? But when you come to the core of this all multifaceted personality, you see him telling that the core issue, why he is successful in all these fields, he will say that his relation with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. See him worshipping in the nights, and you see him how he used to love Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's
his affection, his relation with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That was the core issue. That was the core which hold all the characteristics of this great personality.
That's even at his last moment of the life, when he was struck by the sword, you know, of Ibn al-Muljam, remembering Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, keeping Allah's names in his tongue, you know, really great, okay?
Yeah, because obviously when we look at the narrations by the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, the Prophet says that, O Ali, no one knows you except me and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Very good.
So this is the rank that he had. Obviously, spiritually, the connection that you have with Allah, the more stronger your connection will be, the more stronger you
That's
will
right.
be. And obviously, he was the perfect, we can say, like man, like in Arabic or Persian term, we use insan-e kamil, the word.
Yes.
And we know that the insan-e kamil is someone whose whole life is according to the Quran. And that's why these were known as Quran and Natiq.
Yes.
Because they both are the pairs, like
That's right.
we can say. So that's what we can see in the life of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. And there are many things to talk. Obviously.
Many things to talk, yes. Unfortunately, we do not have that much time for today's discussion. But, you know, still, there are so many other talks. We got another program on RIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, called To My Brother. It's about the main teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam and his universal character. I invite our dear listeners to refer to that program too. But thank you, Imam Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Brother Sajjad Haider, for your presence in the program. viewpoints talking about the universal character and the comprehensive personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we would like to express our condolences again on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Ali alayhi salam in this holy month of Ramadan. Inshallah, Allah gives us a chance of visiting the tomb of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Najaf al-Ashraf one day, inshallah. Do not forget us in your du'as and supplications during this month of Ramadan. You can visit our website at parstoday.com/Yankal of Islam page 2 to another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Ramadanul Mustabin Jaa bin Nuril Mubin Marhaban bit Taibin Marhaban bil Abidin في صلاة الخاشعين في رحاب الذاكرين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Reasonable life. They could spend, they could change their car every 3 years or 2 years. They could go on holidays outside of Iraq. Now, they're taking the $3 a month or $2 a month, US dollars. What can they buy?
Shortly after Russia's attack on Ukraine, the United States, along with a number of European countries, orchestrated an array of sanctions on Moscow. With the ruble falling to a new low, Biden claimed that the sanctions were already working. He said the severe economic sanctions on Putin and all those folks around him, choking off access to technology as well as cutting off access to the global financial system, it's had a profound impact already. Biden's statement, however, is in a stark contrast with the reality of sanctions, economic tools frequently used by the West, in particular the US, yet unable to reach their objectives most of the time, whether it is to end a war, stop genocide, or seek regime change.
Today I'm announcing that we're adding dozens of names to the list, including one of Russia's wealthiest billionaires, and I'm banning travel to America by more than 50 Russian oligarchs, their families, and their close associates.
Among the worst sanction failures, Iraq has an undisputed place. 4 days after Iraq's attack on Kuwait in 1990, the UN imposed sanctions that banned world trade with Baghdad. The UN imposed sanctions that banned world trade with Baghdad. The war ended 6 months later with the US-led military intervention, but the sanctions dragged on. While the sanctions left Iraq's economy in tatters, they had little impact on Saddam Hussein himself. By 2003, it is estimated that nearly 1.5 million Iraqis, primarily children, had died as a direct consequence of sanctions. That's while Saddam Hussein and his inner circle maintained their lavish lifestyles all along.
They used to live a reasonable life. They could spend, they could change their car every 3 years or 2 years. They could go on holidays outside of Iraq. Now, they're taking the $3 a month or $2 a month, US dollars. What can they buy?
Another glaring example is North Korea. Sanctions and embargoes, first imposed on the country after the Korean War in the 1950s, have been a total failure. Despite all the sanctions, Pyongyang has ironically become better armed. The world's most isolated country is now estimated to have dozens of nuclear weapons and long-range missiles. The same failure story of sanctions is true of Cuba, a country which has faced layers of U.S. trade and arms embargoes since 1960. Despite that, communism is still in power in the backyard of the United States. The White House has declared the new sanctions on Russia are based on the Iran model, but four decades of sanctions on Tehran have repeatedly failed to reach their objectives in the country. In the words of Stuart Levy, the Treasury official who orchestrated sanctions on Iran, "I racked up about a million frequent flyer miles to get this much concerted action on Iran." And yet the result is far from satisfactory, not least because the illegal sanctions have prompted the Iranian nation to seek self-dependence in as many fields and areas as possible. Sanctions often prompt a country's population to rally around the flag. Whoever is imposing the sanctions is viewed as the enemy, according to Steve Hank, professor of applied economics at Johns Hopkins University. In other words, sanctions may backfire and not only don't cause regime change, but they might help a nation get more united in the face of the enemy. Under Donald Trump alone, Washington imposed more than 1,000 sanctions on Tehran. The aim was to get the Iranians to negotiate a broader deal than the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement, known also as the JCPOA. But the maximum pressure, as it used to be called, turned out to be an abysmal failure. Tehran made it clear that it was not interested in a new agreement over its peaceful nuclear program, and after the US withdrew from the 2015 agreement, it rolled back its commitments in accordance with the JCPOA. In the case of Russia, while the US and Russia are not dependent on each other, the same is not true of Europe and Russia, at least when it comes to energy. A total economic blockade would likely hurt Europe as much as Russia. Consumers in the UK, for instance, are going to have to come to terms with a lengthy period of rising energy bills to a great extent as a result of sanctions on Russia. By and large, sanctions fail unless there is near universal cooperation from other states. In the case of Cuba, for instance, few other states cooperated with the American embargo, which meant the country could get resources from many sources other than the US. As for Russia, Moscow can likely count on China as a willing buyer of Russian oil and other resources. Moreover, if Moscow faces a restricted number of buyers for oil, China will be able to obtain Russian resources at a discount. It means by imposing sanctions on Russia, the Americans are unintentionally helping its main economic rival have cheaper Russian energy resources. As long as Russia can continue to trade with sizable economies like China, Mexico, and Brazil, it will not face the sort of isolation the US hopes to impose. Sanctions might also bring undesirable side effects. For example, sanctions increase the economic distress on Haiti, triggering a troublesome exodus of people from Haiti to the United States. Or in just another case, military sanctions against Pakistan increased its reliance on a nuclear option because the sanctions cut off Islamabad's access to US weaponry and undermined Pakistani confidence in American reliability. Perhaps South Africa, during the era of racial apartheid, is a rare sanctions success story. Back then, sanctions contributed to the end of apartheid, although it took them almost three decades to work. But even then, sanctions unintentionally helped the country in some important areas. For example, in the face of an embargo on energy imports, the South Africans developed a world-class system to make oil from coal. Or when they were banned from importing arms, they ramped up production and became a net exporter. South Africa was still able to develop its first nuclear device in 1982, and by 1989, it already had six bombs. Despite all the significant flaws in imposing sanctions, the United States still persists on using them. Isn't it time for the Americans to give serious diplomacy a second thought?
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.